Bueno.
You might like to have Mark chapter 14 open in front of you. You find it, well, the most of it on page 1020. It's one of the longest chapters in Mark. And part of my reason for messing with you this evening and laying you out in seating like this is because the first two scenes that we arrive at in Mark chapter 14 begin around the context of meals. Someone said, that's easy then, you should just clear the chairs and make them all lie on the floor. But I thought I wouldn't do that. I thought we would adapt to a Western idea of what it means to sit down for a meal rather than have cushions on the floor. I thought you might be more angry with me if I just made you sit on the floor and recline this evening. But we see in the context of meals. And we start off first with this this anointing of Jesus. This woman, this unknown to us who this woman is in Mark, comes and gives this expensive and this lavish offering, pouring out this this oil worth a huge amount of money. And we see she comes with this depth of worship to Jesus, that she comes and offers this extravagant offering of worship. And we see the people around really kind of sort of trying to make rationalizations because they're uncomfortable, they're upset by what's going on. And verses 4 and 5 really have that sort of feel to them. Some of the people present were saying indignantly to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor. They didn't like what she was doing. It felt excessive to them. If she's doing that, does that mean all the rest of us should do it as well? No, this is excessive and too much. It's embarrassing and it's distasteful. It makes the rest of us feel uncomfortable that we're not doing enough or haven't done it right. But what seemed to upset others, Jesus accepts. Leave her alone, said Jesus in verse 6. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. Jesus doesn't see what she's done as something embarrassing or distasteful, but sees it as something that is beautiful. And goes on to explain how, in some way, intuitively, what she's done is a preparation for his burial. And it points us really from these little bits at the beginning of Mark chapter 14 all the way now through these last chapters of Mark. It is all pointing towards Jesus' death. The chapter began with the chief priests and the teachers of the law scheming to arrest Jesus and kill him. At the end of this section, Judas goes out to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. This woman anoints Jesus, and he says it's preparation for his burial. Everything is now pointing us towards Jesus' death. But as we look at this woman who comes and makes this lavish offering to Jesus, what does that mean for us as we think about our worship and what we offer him? What does it mean for us when we consider the way that maybe we view others in their worship? Are we either like the ones who are grumbling at the sides going, well, that's a bit excessive, isn't it? That's a bit emotional or it's a bit expressive. That's not the way that we do things around here. They must come, they'll learn. How do we view it when people worship perhaps in a bit of a different way to the way that we do? And what does it mean for us to offer that kind of worship to Jesus? The call for us is to offer our love, our worship, with all our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength. What does it mean for us to do that? It'd be easy to read this passage and go, look at this woman who comes and offers her worship without inhibition and doesn't hold anything back, and to make the call for us to do the same. I think the call to worship without any inhibition may be somewhere a long way off for most of us. But I love what Jesus says in verse 8. She did what she could. She did what she could. What does it mean for us to come and offer the depth of worship, whatever it is that we are able to offer to Jesus? Not thinking of others, not comparing ourselves with what others might do, not judging others for what they feel able to do or want to offer. But what does it mean for us to do what we can with our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength to worship Jesus? And I want to begin by offering something of that worship together. We often, and so often, worship together in song. So we're going to sing a few songs. If that connects with you, that's great. And if that's a helpful way for you to worship, that's wonderful. Feel free to move out a bit from the table if that's helpful. We've got space. If you want to make use of space, you can dance, you can kneel, you can lie down, you can do what you'd like. If you want to sit still and worship in that way, that's fine too. If you want to use your mind and read through this chapter or read through Mark or just listen to the words and not sing them, that's okay too. But let's take an opportunity to just challenge ourselves to offer our worship as much as we can with our heart, our soul, our mind and our spirit. With how we're going to share communion this evening, but we don't quite know what we're doing, so we forgot to get anything to wipe the cup with as we pass it around. So John's just gone to get a napkin so that we can do that as we pass it around, so that we're slightly more comfortable with doing it this way, which I know is going to make some uncomfortable anyway. We move from one meal to another, a meal that perhaps we're much more familiar with. But let's not forget that Jesus comes with his disciples around the context of sharing in a meal. I thought about trying to get you some more food this evening that we might share in first. I didn't turn that thought into plan, so all you've got is biscuits. But I know that you still can't quite eat them, even though you're sat in front of them, because, you know, we eat them after we've had the service and after communion, because we aren't used to the context of sharing communion in a meal. But that's what Jesus did. It was within the context of a meal, as they were sat around together. And there's something, I think, deeply human about sharing significant meals around significant events. So often we do it, don't we? A wedding wouldn't feel right if there wasn't a food and a meal involved in some way. Or even in sad times, even around the death of someone, we still often gather together in some way around food. Or celebrating the birth of a child, or a dedication, or a baptism. We go, let's get everyone together for food. A whole array of napkins, thank you. Somehow, there's something about sharing together in food as we come to these significant events. And there's something that it does as we share in those meals, that we become, it's as though we become those who shared in that meal together. That partaking and sharing it binds that group of people together. We were part of that event, whatever it may be, we shared in that meal together to mark it. And so often those meals can say more than words can. And this meal that Jesus shared with his disciples said far more than words possibly could about what it was that Jesus was going to do. And of course it goes on for us, saying again and again, far more than any words could, what it is that Jesus has done for us. And as we share in it together, it changes us. As we share in it together, it changes us to make us be a people who depend upon Jesus and his death for our lives. We become those who shared in this meal together, those who marked Jesus' death, his body given, his blood poured out for us. Jesus shared this meal with his disciples. And so if you're a disciple of Jesus, if you're seeking to follow him, you're welcome to share in this. Let's remember one of those disciples was about to go on and betray Jesus. This wasn't about a people who had it all sorted and all clear. But they were a group who were seeking to follow Jesus. So we're going to share together. We're going to serve it simply, just passing it around the table to serve one another. If you don't wish to take it, just pass it on to the next person. As you pass it on to the next person, you might like to say, the body of Jesus given for you, or the blood of Jesus shed for you. But if you stumble over those words or you don't quite know what to say, just pass it on, it's fine. Just say simply, this is for you, if no other words come to mind. And we're going to use the words that we have recorded here in Mark. that while they were eating, Jesus took bread and then he gave thanks. And so Celia is going to lead us in prayer as we give thanks for the bread. Into the rest of this chapter, and we see played out again and again through the coming verses this contrast of the faithful and the unfaithful. Jesus comes into the garden or Gethsemane and he prays and he seeks his Father, and we have this moment of deep intimacy as he comes to God and cries out to him in verse 36, Abba, Father. And many of us will know the depth of meaning behind that word. It's why it's put there as Abba for us, that cry out to a father as a dad. Yes, it was a word that a child would use, but it isn't a childish word. It's a word of intimacy. Daddy. Dad, this depth of intimacy as Jesus comes and he prays to his Father. And in his anguish, he calls out to God saying, is there not another way? If there's any other way. And even in that anguish, he still says, but not what I want, but what you want. Not what I will, but what you will. And it's stating the obvious. But Jesus' prayer here, his ask for another way, the Father says no. He says there isn't another way. We know that because Jesus goes to the cross. Even Jesus was told no in prayer. There's not another way. And yet Jesus is faithful. He doesn't do the Jonah and go, well, I'll tell you what, I'll go somewhere else then. Jesus is the faithful one. And yet three times he returns to his disciples, his closest friends, his closest followers, and finds them in his moment of anguish, in his moment of pain, and finds them asleep. I'm sure many of us have known something of that. That moment when you're looking for someone who you might depend on, you might rely on, and you go and you turn to them and you find that they're just not there for you. Jesus, three times, finds his friends asleep. In his darkest hour. And you've got the contrast of Jesus' prayer and his passion and his pain and his intimacy with the Father to the disciples' slumber. The faithful one and the unfaithful. Those who couldn't even keep watch for an hour. And then Judas enters. Judas comes and betrays Jesus with a kiss. With a sign of love and friendship and affection, turned to be the sign of betrayal. And verse 50 we read, then everyone deserted him and fled. In some of the other, one of the other Gospels, it talks about the disciples deserted. Mark doesn't even use the word disciples because they're not following Jesus anymore. They're running away. Everyone deserted him and fled. And verse 51, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. It's often thought or suggested that perhaps this young man is Mark, who wrote the gospel himself, but partly because we don't get that little anecdote in any of the other gospels, so maybe Mark included it about himself. We don't know for certain, but it's a reasonable idea. But we have this picture of this disciple, this follower of Jesus, fleeing naked in a garden. It's meant to point us back to Genesis 3, of the first people to sin, hiding naked in a garden. The disgrace, the sin, the unfaithfulness of the disciples is made complete. And in the midst of all this, in the midst of this, all of this unfaithfulness, Jesus remains calm and accepting. Verse 48, am I leading a rebellion, said Jesus, that you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. He's calm and accepting. But the scriptures must be fulfilled. Whilst this is unfaithfulness all around, Mark paints us the picture of Jesus, the faithful servant, fulfilling scripture. And we find then Jesus before the Sanhedrin. And the principal charge that they're trying to lay upon him is Jesus as a false prophet. Because if he's a false prophet, then under the Jewish law they can get rid of him, they can kill him. But they can't seem to quite pin that charge upon him. They can't get evidence that's going to line up and agree to pin Jesus down as a false prophet. So the high priest comes to Jesus with this alternative kind of question, this other way of trying to pin him down about whether he is the Messiah. Verse 61. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? And of course, under Jewish law, it's not an offence to be the Messiah. It might be laughable to claim that you're the Messiah. It'd be a bit like, you know, someone going around today saying they are the second coming of Jesus. You know, we might laugh at someone about that kind of thing, but we wouldn't say that was worthy of death. But of course, the claim to be the Messiah was a claim to be king. And that was a threat to Rome. And so if they could take him to the governor as one who claimed to be king, then that might be something worthy of crucifixion. And there's this deep irony in the words in this passage that the high priest come. Because in Greek, there's a way that you can kind of ask a question assuming the answer. So he actually comes and asks him whether he's the Christ, the Messiah, in a way that assumes the answer is going to be yes. And actually the words that are written down in the Greek are, "You are the Christ." And it's exactly the same words that are used when Peter declared Jesus to be the Christ, the Messiah, back in chapter 8. Just before Peter comes and denies those words. And Jesus says in verse 62, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." It's a short statement with a really rich picture to what it is that Jesus is saying. But in essence, he's saying to him, yes, I am a prophet, and you will see me vindicated. You will see that I really am a true prophet. And in fact, more than that, you will see that I share the very throne of God. And for the high priest, that's enough to lay the charge on him of blasphemy. Blasphemy, he cries out, so well acted out on the video. And they mock him as a false prophet. They beat him and say, "Well, who was it who hit you? Prophesy, you're a prophet, then go on, show us." In this deep irony that the next scene we read of is Jesus' prophecy that Peter would betray him, exactly acted out. Mark vindicates Jesus as a prophet while they mock him for being a false one. And then we come to Peter. Peter, who three times denies Jesus. We know the scene full well. Imagine for Peter, having your denials of Jesus written into the foundation documents. And we see this deep contrast. There's a little Mark and sandwich that we see Peter arrive and then Jesus on trial, and then we come back to Peter. We see Jesus retain his integrity, confessing who he is at the cost of his life. And we see Peter lose his integrity to save his own life. And perhaps suddenly, in Peter's tears, we see acted out for us what Jesus had said back in chapter 8, shortly after Peter declares who he is. Chapter 8, verse 35, "Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." Sometimes at Easter we have the refrain, "Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" I want to ask this evening the question, who are we in this scene? Who were we in this scene? Because, of course, we want to be the ones who are faithful, I hope. not the unfaithful. We want to be the ones who'll stand with Jesus. And so I want to ask the question today, how are we called to watch and pray as Jesus asked the disciples to? How are we called to watch and pray with Jesus for ourselves, for others? What are the things that he wants us to stay awake and pray for today? How are we called to stand with Jesus? Jesus comes and is falsely accused, is arrested in injustice, and everyone deserts him. How are we called today to stand with Jesus in the face of injustice? And today, how are we called to confess Jesus, even when it's at great personal cost? How are we called to not do what Peter did, but to be those who will stand and say, we know him. Where are the places? Who are the people? We've got to ask us to say, we know this Jesus. And we're sat nicely together. And so I'm going to give you the chance to think about those things for yourselves, or talk about them with those around you. And those sort of thoughts are going to appear up on the screen. Thanks, Linda. And I'm going to give you a few minutes, to talk about those things together. How are we called today to watch and pray for ourselves, for others? How are we called to stand with Jesus against injustice? How are we called today to confess him, even at personal cost? Three big questions. You might want to just pick one. You might want to think about it on your own. If you want to, that's fine. There's space to chat about it with others. If it doesn't make sense, you can come and ask me what on earth I'm trying to get at. So a few minutes to talk about it. You can turn me off, that'd be great, thank you. Thanks, Linda. Off you go.